Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We can learn a great deal from these places that should be the worst places in the world, but are not. And I think they really show us something about that, quote unquote, the healing power of nature. There's just so much capacity for regeneration, regrowth. You know, these are our redemption stories.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of On Jimmy's Farm with me, Jimmy Doherty. This is the podcast where we discuss everything to do with the natural world and the environment and try and give everyone a slice of the good life along the way. Now, I'm just out checking the grass growth on one of my paddocks because hopefully we'll be turning out the cows pretty soon. And the weather's been brilliant. The grass is coming up lovely and lush. You want it not too short. And you don't want it too long either. You want it just right. Oh, it's coming on well. Looking good. I'm out here with my lovely little dog, Whiskey, my Irish Terrier. She's looking ever so smart. She's just had a haircut. She went in looking like a ball of fluff, and she can't hear me, but she came out looking like a skinny rat. Hey, Whiskey, come on. Don't be shy. You're feeling the wind, aren't you? With all your fur being trimmed like that. So today, I've got a wonderful guest, and that's Cal Flynn. Now, Cal is an award-winning author, and she's written a wonderful book called The Islands of Abandonment. And it's a subject that's fascinated me ever since I was a little boy, and it's basically how nature returns when man abandons various buildings, towns, cities, you name it. And I love the idea of it being like an island. And sometimes it can be like an island. She talks about islands in Scotland where the cattle have gone back to being feral. But it could be an island because of man-made disturbances or pollution like Chernobyl. So it's a really interesting chat. And it's one that I find really gives you hope because it demonstrates that no matter how bad things get, nature always finds a way back. So enjoy the chat, and I'll see you all back here, back in the meadow. Hi, Cal, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks very much.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on Jimmy's Farm, my little podcast. I'm really excited to talk to you about your amazing new book, Islands of Abandonment, because it is a subject matter that has fascinated me since I was a little kid. The idea of what happens when you abandon areas of land or buildings and how nature comes back. So tell me a bit about how you came to the idea of the book.
Well, I first got interested in the subject to write about, I suppose, when I went wild swimming in the Slate Islands off the west coast of Scotland. So those are quite near Oban, if you know the area, and they were the epicentre of the slate quarrying industry in the 19th century. But today they're quite overgrown. They're just covered in sort of scree, and all the old deep quarries have flooded with seawater. And so some people, you know, they have the stone skimming world championships there once a year, and people go wild swimming there, and it's very pretty. So I ended up writing an essay about the aesthetics of places like this, the post-industrial, and how they can sort of be weirdly beautiful. And there are, you know, artists and photographers who work in this. There's an amazing Canadian photographer called Edward Bertinsky who takes these huge, large format photos of post-industrial sites that are really amazing to look at. And I think I found that really interesting, this sort of political tension between the damage that these places were doing and yet the sort of visual element of it. So I wrote an essay about that. And then I kept sort of thinking about it. I just couldn't stop thinking about it because it made me think afresh about how to value landscapes and how things can be valuable in one sense, but very unvaluable in other senses. And the more I read about it, the more kind of interesting science I found in this area about how brownfield sites can actually be really biodiverse, and all sorts of unexpected stuff kept coming up. And it just slowly coalesced into kind of a bigger thesis, a book. And I guess it all fell into place when I started figuring out how I was going to structure it. And I realised I could go to different places, and each of these places could be somehow symbolic of another aspect of abandonment. So, yeah, that's where it came from.
Right. So hence the title Islands of Abandonment, because these little areas, I say small areas, they're little areas, they're not at all, are they? They're quite substantial. And you went to almost like 13 different areas and some really sort of iconic places like Chernobyl.
Yeah, that's right. This concept of islands, it began literally and it became metaphorical as well. This idea of the island is often used in ecology to think about sort of areas of land. So E.O. Wilson talked about island biodiversity, by which he meant sort of like islands of forests. So the bigger the forest, the better, and the smaller the forest, island. In his formulation, kind of there would be less scope for biodiversity. And so I took that idea and sort of ran with it. So my islands, some of them are literal islands. There's Inchkeith in the Firth of Forth near Edinburgh. There's Swona, an abandoned island, actually quite near me, just off Orkney, sort of between Orkney and the north coast of Scotland. But others, yeah, as you say, there's like exclusion zones, which act as islands in otherwise like very tended landscapes. So the Chernobyl exclusion zone, you know, it's in a bit of an unknown situation at the moment. You know, a lot of what I wrote about in the chapter is now very bittersweet, because so much of the amazing flourishing that has been happening in Chernobyl has entirely depended upon the stability of that area. And it was being run quite securely by the Ukrainian government before, and we just don't know what's going on there. But what we had seen over the last few decades is this sort of resurgence of wildlife. We saw a return of wolves to the zone because it was very depopulated, very uncontrolled. We saw bears, all sorts of cranes, other species that don't like the presence of humans. I think they are really fascinating. I'm arguing in the book not that we should have more abandoned places, because often they have very tragic human stories behind them, but that we can learn a great deal from these places that should be the worst places in the world, but are not. And I think they really show us something about that, you know, quote unquote, the healing power of nature. There's just so much capacity for regeneration, regrowth. You know, these are redemption stories.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing, I think, is that when you look at the environment as a subject for writers, I mean, I'm not saying it's a boom time at the moment, but there's lots of different environmental crises that are in the headlines. But when you're writing about the environment, it's a very difficult thing to write about, because you want to do the subject justice, but you don't want to have so much doom and gloom that it totally depresses people when they stop reading. But equally, you don't want to be sort of too much of a light touch where you don't really examine the extent of what's happening. But with your book, it does offer those glimpses of hope and nature can come back, which I think is really powerful and a really important message.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it really depends on your personality, but I find, you know, I read a lot about the environment. I have this tendency towards despair. So when I read so much about how hopeless this situation is, I really do find it sort of difficult to keep my head in the game, so to speak. I almost like switch off after a while. And so like for me, it was an element of balancing those two things. It's that dark and light in the same place, that chiaroscuro of, I don't know, style. And I do think it's very important if you're writing about hope in the environment, you know, you have a responsibility when you also have to bang on a little bit about how bad it is and how bad we've made it. But at the same time, I really felt the need for glimmers of hope and to have that sense of the plants coming through the cracks in the pavement, because that allows people like me to get up in the morning and think, okay, yes, it looks bad, but there's a way forward here. And I think that that's really important when we talk about motivation. You know, so many people who work in climate science and all sorts of related fields do suffer from, you know, what they call climate grief. And after a while, it's a special kind of burnout. So finding ways to keep ourselves going is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you feel like you're being hit over the head so much with so much doom and gloom. But the subject matter of the book, I love it, because as a kid, I was always fascinated by what would happen if we all disappeared and how would nature come back. And when I was a student, I lived in Coventry and I used to travel to Stratford-upon-Avon to visit the Tropical Butterfly House there. And we used to pass Aleister Crowley's old house. He wrote the Book of Black Magic, and it had this big old house and the roof had caved in and there were trees growing through the building. And because it was Aleister Crowley and it all sort of looked a bit sinister, it really caught your imagination. The places that you visited, what really sticks in your mind? Like, wow, this is incredible how nature has come back in these really quite difficult environments.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's definitely a darkness to these places, and that's why, you know, the Aleister Crowley identity of that place sort of adds a depth to it. You know, like when you look at these very aestheticized images of ruined places that you find online, they're almost invariably described as like abandoned asylums or like abandoned sanatoriums, you know, or like whatever their history is. Often they're not. They're just like big old houses, but it gives like a depth to them. Yeah, I don't know. It's I think part of it is that darkness and light thing we were talking about. You want some kind of like, narratively speaking, your brain is looking for this like human darkness in the story. And then the redemption is represented by the plants. And the sense, I guess, of like life continues. One day all of this will be dust. All of that kind of, I don't know, abandoned places. To me, one of the reasons that they're so powerful in the way that they act in my brain is because they sort of remind me that I'm small. Abandoned places, especially ruins, are kind of like visual reminders of the passage of time. So like you go into them and it confronts you with your own significance and also with the enormousness of the world. And that does something to your brain a little bit, sort of blows it. So I think that's why they have such powerful psychological impact on us.
And there's this sort of rebirth out of an old building or an abandoned factory or whatever it is. And the edges become soft when you sort of get ivy growing over and then birds are nesting in. And that whole rebirth is really quite powerful. But there's an interesting element where we just think about the plants reestablishing themselves and the beginnings of ecosystems. But of course, the animals are pretty quick to turn up and you've got wildlife. But what about animals that have left behind? So domestic animals?
It's kind of a mix. The clearest example I have from my own sort of travels is the island of Swona. So this is one off the north coast of Scotland. And there, a small herd of domestic cattle, really probably less than 10, were left in 1979 with the intention that they would go back and get them. It wasn't a couple, it was a brother and sister who were living on this very remote island, left because they were very elderly, and they'd kept these animals all their lives. So they were quite sort of domestic and well cared for. And then suddenly overnight, they were sort of left to their own devices. And they've been there since the late 70s. They've been breeding, they've survived, which wasn't always expected to happen because there isn't very much shelter up here, not very much food. So they don't get any extra food, and in the winter they get by kind of from eating seaweed and things like that. And what has happened there is A, they've sort of reverted to a kind of wild type, or certainly a wild behaviour. I'm interested in like that boundary between feral and wild. And in terms of the ecology of the island, what they do is cattle, when they graze, is slightly less intensive than sheep, so it's a very wildflower-rich island. So yes, they certainly play a role in the ecology of these places. And I know in other sites, I looked at abandoned farmland in Estonia, and generally sort of looking at the post-Soviet world, because there's a huge amount of abandoned farmland there. There's a lot of discussion. I was interested in the carbon sinking of the forest that's growing up there, a lot of forest growing up very densely over there. But in Estonia, there are some conservationists working to bring in cattle, especially that sort of longhorn cattle type thing, a very hardy thing, similar type to what's going on in Swona, in the hope that they might sort of be almost feral, that they would not be farmed exactly, but that they would be, I don't know, causing there to be a more biodiverse environment and a less dense forest. So yes, I think definitely domestic animals can play a role. They don't always survive. There's like a lot of wild, well, feral dogs in Chernobyl, for example, and like my translator, we'd often feed them. So dogs often survive. When it comes to domestic animals, they are very dependent on us. So it's a bit of a mixed picture.
It is interesting with those cattle, though, because if you were to look at the cattle in a farming context, that the idea that you'd have a herd of breeding cattle, so they'd all be female, and you'd keep, say, one or two bulls for breeding. But if they're just left feral, then that dynamics would change. Over time, they'd come to be almost 50-50 male and female. 50% of the calves on average would be either a male or a female. So that dynamics of the sexes would change. So you'd have a lot of young bulls there. Does their behaviour revert back to, say, what the ancient auroch would have been like? Because the aurochs were the original wild cattle. Do they revert back? Because there's wild cattle, Chillingham cattle at the estate up in Cumbria, where they live pretty much like they would in the wild. Did you see that sort of behaviour?
Yeah, so just through sort of random chance, we've seen like a big change in the gender makeup of the cattle on the island. And they're very contained on this very small island. I think it's like 1 mile end to end. And so there was a period, I think it was in the 90s, when there were actually more males than females. And it was like a period of great strife, you know, like they were constantly fighting. There were like breakoff groups that would be stuck on tiny headlands. You know, they'd have honestly like a 100 meter square area for them to survive on, because if they went into the main part of the island with the rest of the herd, they'd be like pushed back. It's definitely much more peaceful in the land of the cattle when the females are predominating, and they've seen this change in behavior. And sometimes it was really quite extreme, and the bulls on Swona can become really huge. They've got some Aberdeen Angus breeding, so they are quite sort of solid animals. So like if they're fighting, it's the dominant theme of the island, and it was like that for several years. So yes, definitely you see a lot of behaviors that you don't see in domestic cattle. And I think when I went out there, you know, I grew up in the countryside, although I'm not a dairy farmer or a beef farmer, and it really surprised me, I think, being so used to cattle being this almost like benevolent presence in the fields around me in my life, to sort of go to a place where actually they've been almost like a warring race of beings. So I just found it really fascinating. And this can be the same in other feral herds. So there was quite a famous feral herd on Amsterdam Island, although they have now all been killed, I suppose, for conservation reasons, because they've been important. And you sometimes find them in places like Australia or bits of America where there's like open grazing. Sometimes the small herds will break off and start behaving like feral cattle, and they can be quite aggressive. So it is really like living alongside animals that we've been sort of underestimating for a long time, or certainly many of us are, maybe not everyone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's unbelievable, because I think the idea of nature returning, but also if you look at our domestic animals, thousands of years of domestication, but just scratch the surface a little bit and that wild ancestor is there, isn't it? It's you know, the behaviours come back and they revert back to type, which I often see in my animals with the pigs. And, you know, if you put them in the woods, often you think, well, are they going to survive? Well, of course they're going to survive in the woods, because they've originally were wild boar. And so those instincts still, you know, remain. My imagination, thinking about these areas and these places, it does let your imagination run wild, the possibilities. What about areas where
the absence of man has led nature to sort of really proliferate. Have you seen that on certain islands or certain areas where you could almost, there's very few places in the world you can go to where man hasn't left his footprint, you know, it hasn't been someone that arrived or done something. But when you see nature come back and the absence of man, does nature almost forget man? Does nature almost sort of think, you know, it's you're an unwelcome guest, you don't really belong?
I think less that than I realised that man is almost like just another natural force. You know, because the way that things are recolonized is the same as if, you know, I don't know, there was a volcano, you know, that tarmac across a landscape might be very similar to, I don't know, lava spreading and hardening and then over years falling apart, you know. So I think I began to see how we sort of fit into it and that damage by us is not necessarily worse. It's still damage, but it can be come back from in the same way that other enormous natural forces can be. I guess this thing about human damage is that at the moment it's being done on such an enormous scale and almost constantly. So I think that helps me also understand a little bit about how things do recover, you know, the various natural processes that are already in place that sort of are not even swinging into action when something bad happens, but they're just constantly going all the time looking for opportunities. You know, like if you have seeds raining down on a place and most of the time they land places which is simply not conducive to them growing. But it's just like constantly looking for opportunities, all these different species. You know, we saw this at the beginning of lockdown when, I don't know, we saw some kangaroos wandering down streets. That's not because literally the city was reverting, but it was the very first stage. You know, like there are all of these species living alongside us all the time, always looking for opportunities to spread, to space out. And I think that is moving. People find that moving. And I think, you know, we've got to temper the way that we react to things because, like, we're so ready to hear how easily things can recover. You know, like that's why we jumped on those pictures of the dolphins and all of these kind of things. And I think it's understanding that's not necessarily recovery happening right now. It's just it's constantly happening all the time. And I find that really reassuring that, you know, like there's always, I don't know, kangaroos looking for opportunities.
I love the idea of just a mob of kangaroos hanging around just waiting for an opportunity to spring into action. But I saw that at the farm when we had the lockdown happened and we couldn't have visitors. It changed the behaviour of our animals on the farm, both domestic and wild animals, because we have a wildlife park. Some of their behaviours changed with the absence of people, but the wildlife surrounding that changed massively, where we would have herons come in and feed on the ducklings, and we would have a lot more sort of stoats and weasels. They'd become emboldened and, you know, they reclaimed certain areas of the farm. You could see the wildlife streaming in. But I think what's fascinating is that when you take us out of the equation, what happens and how much can nature come back? Is it in huge abundance? I mean, have you been to places where you've just gone, I can't believe the wildlife that's here?
Yeah, I guess Chernobyl was a little bit like that just because of the scale of what we were looking at. You know, the zone which had largely been farmland or sort of these commuter cities, small cities, is now 70% forest. Like I saw deer the very second that we crossed over. We had to go through these like radiation scanners and then we got back into the vehicle and started driving. And then it was just like loads of deer on the side of the road. You know, like it was like entering a deer park. There were so many of them around. And Plymouth, which is the former capital of Montserrat, which is an island in the Caribbean. I went there because of the southern half of the island roughly has been in a very strict exclusion zone because of a volcanic eruption which rumbled on since the sort of early noughties. And there, I think because of the climate, it's tropical. It means that has become grown over so fast in the areas that are not consistently being covered in dust and ash and so on. And that was really amazing. You know, I saw iguanas sort of coming out of the old police station, which was full of ferns. You know, everything's grown over and there's all these kind of creepers and everything. And partly for me, it was like especially moving because like that sort of rainforest jungle type vegetation is not kind of what I've grown up with. So it was sort of weird and strange and exciting. Yeah. And you can see how quickly, especially in a climate like that, really human artifacts can disappear. You know, anything that can rots very fast. And so it's just left with like the skeleton of the buildings. And in one place, just on the edge of where the eruptions have been coming down, the force of the eruptions had taken off one wall of a hotel and the inside of the hotel was full of like solidified ash. And you could see, I don't know, you could see like a toilet sort of sticking out because the whole wall had come off. It was a cross section of the building. You could see inside the guts of the building. And it was, I don't know, like being at Pompeii or something like this. And you can see how our own civilization, our own culture, like today's way of living, being preserved for the future for people to rediscover the way that we have discovered so much about the way of living during the Pompeii era. So I don't know, just that density of vegetation and that being so contrasted with the almost like the deadness of the scene of everything sealed up inside them.
You can see how that nature is just waiting to come back. And when we look at things like marine environments, it's well known and well documented if there's a shipwreck or you can sink large vessels to create reefs, which have an amazing effect on the wildlife. In a couple of generations, you've got a well-established coral reef from an old ship or whatever else, and it's teeming with wildlife. But what can we learn on terrestrial environments? What can we learn from abandoned buildings or we go to brownfield sites? And I pass on the train to London. There's a massive factory that has been cleared and demolished. But I was often thinking, is there something we could do to assist that sort of natural regeneration? Is there new ways of thinking about our abandoned places?
The brownfield sites are really interesting, often because they are so rich in biodiversity, even though they really don't look like there will be bug life. The charity is doing amazing work in this area of like protecting sites that appear very derelict and unlikable, like the former oil terminal in Canvey Vic is a famous example. It's been described as a brownfield wilderness because of the density, particularly of invertebrate life. And invertebrate life love this open mosaic habitat. So that tends to be in brownfield sites. It tends to be where there's like little bits of tarmac here, like weird stagnant pools, a bit of scrub coming through there, some fallen down walls, all in close proximity. And that's really good for creatures that have life cycles that require different stages. So that's particularly insects, but other things too. I don't know if necessarily we can like kickstart these things, because so much of it is about time and stability and those random processes coming down. I mean, you might protect these sites more or possibly damage the tarmac to allow sort of more sort of cracks and so on. But I think a large part of why these places are so good happens almost by serendipity. Mm. And the question is, when can we recognize how valuable they are? And that tends to be people going out and surveying them, looking for rare species, looking for biodiversity, all of that kind of thing. I've been chatting sort of off and on to a group in the southwest of Scotland who have been trying to save this site called Ardeer from redevelopment. It was a dynamite factory, but factory makes it sound like a building. Really, it was a sort of spread out over a huge, huge area on this sort of peninsula of dunes. Lots of huts where people would stuff the dynamite into tubes and a few sort of smaller buildings. And just this like weird sort of semi-blasted landscape with lots of fallen down buildings and the diversity of that site. So this is very much not a pristine landscape. That has made it very valuable for lots of different species. And so they're trying to save that from redevelopment, for bits of it being turned into a golf course, that kind of thing. So yeah, I think it's learning to allow this untidiness to coexist with us, ourselves.
I think the element of old buildings and things like that, when I was a kid, if you found an old barn or something, that's where we used to go and catch grass snakes, or you'd watch beetles in the wood and there'd be all this sort of life because there's materials that animals can use. But I suppose the common thing running through a lot of the areas that you examined is that they're dangerous, or there are places where people don't go because there's been a chemical leak, or there's been radioactive contamination, or an old battlefield or whatever it is. And it's often these places, an abandoned factory, do not enter, dangerous, that allows nature to be protected. So the element of dangerous to humans, in a way, is almost like a protective barrier for a nature reserve to appear.
Yeah, exactly. Especially in these sites, I talk about them as being almost like forbidden experiments because it'd be immoral to create them. But so there's like a trade-off, right? There's like the fear that they engender in people, particularly places like Chernobyl. But also, I write about that clearing in the woods in Verdun in France, which is very frightening to people because it's full of arsenic. And there I was there to write about metallophyte plants, so plants that actually quite like heavy metals. And I think that what it gave me a sense of was this great sense of trade-off all the time, that some things are dangerous, but other benefits might come.
But these unusual environments, you know, this is all like a new frontier of biology in a way. And have you... You're not a biologist by training, are you? But have you developed so many different skills, from soil science to entomology, marine biology? It's a whole new world.
Yeah, it is a whole new world. And I think like a lot of it has been teaching it to myself on the hoof, watching lectures online and so on. So I think the important thing to me is, like, you know, I'm writing for general environment, so I'm not doing cutting edge research myself. That's okay. That's the way that I can talk myself into it, being like, okay, just understand a bit of earth science, talk to some academics, you know, just make sure you've got a grip of it so that you've got enough to be able to write at the level of the intelligent layperson, because that's who I'm sort of aiming myself at. That's good, though, in some senses. Sometimes I was like, oh, why don't I do this for years? Why don't I have a PhD? And then other times I was like, but the good thing is, if you come in reasonably fresh with quite like I've got a like sort of scientific background more generally, you can retain some of this like sense of like surprise and wonder. So like lots of just the concepts of, yeah, like that concept of sea drain, for example, or the concept of metallophyte plants. I'm like, whoa, that's mind-bending, you know.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about this more? We should talk about this more. This is wild, you know.
Yeah.
So I think having that sense of sort of like crazy enthusiasm is a good thing.
I think every town planner should read your book, because when we look at brownfield sites, you can either, you know, demolish them, build something else, or what do we do in these areas? But because an old building has the architecture, it's a dynamic structure. Planting it up with trees at different levels, or creating nesting areas for solitary bees, or little pools of water that you get rare mosquitoes breeding in, all these kinds of sort of stuff that are the basis of really quite rare ecosystems, are really important and have huge value. But we just see it as a tumbling old wreck. But I think we're seeing now developers that are moving into, there's a big shopping centre that's going to be semi-rewild and have different structures, but still have use for people to, you know, walk through and see the splendour of nature. There's something to celebrate about an old building. We often see it as a mess. And I'm looking at an old shed out the window now, and it's tumbled down. It's got ivy over it and all the rest of it. And there's blackbirds that are going to be nesting in there, and you know, there's a whole lot of life going. We should maybe utilize some of these old structures rather than just clear them away.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you were talking about like the value of old barns a second ago, and so much of, I don't know, the fall off and things like barn owls has been because all the new buildings that we build now are so like hermetically sealed that really we make it like a one species space. When before, you know, if they're a bit tumbled down or a bit fallen, or there's just like gaps in the way that they're built, that actually does create lots of space for other things. So yes, obviously we don't love rotting wood in our buildings, but other insects do, you know. So I think learning to sort of live alongside these things is really important. It is difficult, I think, because dereliction has quite like a powerful impact on us. So I talked a little bit earlier about how like I find them thrilling and beautiful and all of that, but also people do find them depressing, and
yeah,
so that's why they don't want them around all the time. And you know, when they looked at the High Line in New York, which had been like a sort of derelict stretch of train track and had been actually full of plants and animals that had popped up there all by themselves. Actually, when they came to celebrate it, what they did was replant it because it wasn't pretty. You know, like if you talk about this, the splendor of nature, you do kind of want it to be sort of dramatic, you know? So I think that's difficult, because I don't know how happy people would be about, you know, making a new shopping centre in which everything looked a little bit drab.
It's got to look good. If you're going to let it go, you've got to make it look spectacular. But, you know, that is important. I think dereliction of an old building, often people associate with failure. You know, it's a tragedy. There's failure. But I think what we should view it as is as a triumph of nature, maybe, as a phoenix rising. And you look at sort of the iconic buildings like Battersea Power Station. I think that's been... There's umpteen ideas of redeveloping all that kind of stuff. It's being redeveloped at the moment. But, I mean, that could have a forest inside it, or it could have, you know, so it becomes a a natural spectacle that you celebrate all the old structures because, you know, the sides of the buildings are almost like a cliff face. You know, you can have peregrine falcons nesting there. So I think there's definitely a way of looking at our old buildings again. And I think what your book does is it does give that glimmer of hope in a sea of despair when it comes to the environment. And there are problems, massive problems, but we need to have hope and we need to, you know, have that shiny light to help us all carry on.
Yes, I think so. I hope so. And the book does seem to have had a good effect on a lot of people. And, you know, I've had lots of people writing to me to be like, oh, I'm getting involved in this local group. We're trying to save this brownfield site. So I don't know. I find that very moving. And I'm so pleased that other people have sort of tuned into it. I do feel like it's like a retuning of the eyes. Suddenly I started noticing these places in a way I hadn't before. Noticing those like scrappy plants that are like growing up the sides of houses. And in fact, probably before, if I did look at them at all, I would have looked at them in kind of a disapproving way of being like, oh, somebody's got to get a hold of that buddleia. It's going to do real damage. So I don't know. It is like, I do feel like a sort of veil has lifted and suddenly I'm like, oh, wow, look at that. Ooh, wow, look at that. You know, the pattern of these things growing back. And if you appreciate it, it kind of changes your whole outlook.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me of the first day I arrived at the farm and the whole place was derelict and nature had taking it back. And I still like the wild areas. And also, if I've got an old building that needs doing up, I think, oh, this has given the excuse now. My wife will go, you need to sort that out. That's all got smashed windows and put the... I'm like, no. It's a temple for nature. It's a lazy conservationist.
Exactly, yeah.
But listen, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And your book is wonderful and it really strikes a chord with me. Particularly, it makes me feel like a child again when I look at the possibilities of nature coming back and taking hold of, you know, some of the mess that we left behind. It's been fascinating to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much. Just such a delight to be here. Thanks for your time.
Brilliant. I'll talk to you again. All the best. See you, Cal.
Bye.
Right, well, hope you enjoyed that chat. I'm still out here in the glorious sun walking through the meadow. I've just done my rounds. I think the cows can come out here next week. Grass is looking good now, a lot of clover. Don't know where Whiskey's gone. Whiskey is either feels really sorry for herself because of her short haircut or she's found some rabbits. But Cal, what an amazing person, fantastic guest. The book she's written, you've got to get a copy, Islands of Abandonment. I love the subject matter and it's fascinating the fact that nature can come back no matter what we throw at it. But also the idea that we've got to give nature a helping hand. You know, you do that and it does return. You know, the fish return in the oceans, the rainforest will return if you give it half a chance. So for me, it's a chink of light and it's inspiration to push on and give nature that helping hand. Now, if you've enjoyed this chat, this episode, then like, subscribe, leave comments wherever you get your podcast, and I will see you back on the farm for another episode of On Jimmy's Farm. Now, where has that dog gone? Whiskey, come on.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.